We're in Ecclesiastes again this evening. You're probably not too surprised to hear that. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, a passage of scripture that I think all of us are quite familiar with, at least the first eight verses. Ecclesiastes 3 this evening. We're going to try to look at the whole chapter. I think we can do this. It's like eating cauliflower at some parts of Ecclesiastes. You know, you have to do it, so you just eat it real fast. And so I'm tempted to do a chapter at a time, but I just can't do that. I mean, we'll slow down a little bit here, but all of chapter 3 this evening, because it all fits so well together in one nice chunk, all right? Father, help us as we study Ecclesiastes. Surely up to this point, it has been so illustrative, so accurate about life as we just try to live life, pursue life, get a handle on life, and in the process forget about you. Remind us again this evening that life is about you. And when we ignore you, when we neglect you, when we get so busy that we don't spend time with you, life gets pretty frustrating, and it ought to. So remind us again this evening that this is your plan. You're in charge. You're in control. And if we would just remember that and live according to that reality, we sure would enjoy life a whole lot more. Teach us, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, the other day I sent a text to Robin, our IT guy, and I told him that the clock for our security cameras was wrong. It's about 20 minutes off. So he replied with an email sent back that he had reset the time. Everything's going to be fine. He said this: apparently it isn't updating automatically. Keep me posted when it loses a minute. And we do know, you know, when something is more than a minute off. My question is this: is that a good reputation or is that a bad reputation to have? You know, I'm one of those odd people who believes that if I'm not 5 minutes early, I'm late. Now, the good news is everybody's not like that, okay? Not everybody agrees with me, and that's a good thing. And not everybody is chained to a clock the way that I am. So I think Solomon in this text gives us a whole lot better way to live our lives. This text is going to be about discovering God's timing. If we understand God's timing, life is so much easier. You know, this chapter 3, it isn't about all that frustration and discouragement that we saw in the first couple of chapters as the preacher was experimenting with life and trying to discover what life was like. Here we don't see that. You know, chapter 3, the importance is to learn that God is in control, that He has a time for everything. His timing is always perfect, and we are very wise to learn about that and submit to it. Learning that God is in control and submitting to His control is the solution. It's the answer to a life of vanity, a life of emptiness. And we know from our own experience how important timing is, right? If you are in the wrong place at the wrong time, that is a formula for disaster. If you are in the wrong place at the right time, you're going to miss an opportunity. If you're in the right place at the wrong time, you're going to miss an opportunity. If you're in the right place at the right time, you're going to be able to enjoy God's blessing. And there's where you'll find the opportunity to learn that God is in control, and you'll be able to learn about His will and His character for your life. And so finding the right place at the right time, that's the theme of our text here this evening. When God's people fit into God's will and God's timing, we just suddenly realize life has meaning, life has purpose, life has fulfillment, and that's a life that would otherwise be characterized by vanity and emptiness and pointlessness. So, our text is familiar. If you've purchased groceries in a grocery store or ever ridden in an elevator, which probably includes just about all of you, chances are pretty good that you've heard verses 1 through 8 put to music, right? Sure you have. Pete Seeger wrote the original song back in the 1950s. Well, in 1965, the Byrds released a new version of it to a song titled Turn, Turn, Turn. And you older folks remember that song, and that's what you hear in the elevator, okay? It's that old song. I have a friend who, just a little bit older than I am, not too much, but he attended a very, very conservative Christian college. Before he went to college, he had this job where, when he was in high school, he would record jingles for a local radio station doing advertisements. So he's pretty proficient. He was a pretty good musician in certain genres of music. And he also happened to be unsaved, even when he went to college. Well, he got to college, and he saw an opportunity where he would be able to perform at this student body kind of function. So he went to the authorities who approved the music for these kinds of things, and he said, listen, I'd like to sing Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 1 through 8. What could possibly be wrong with singing scripture, you know? So they said, sure, go ahead. And so he gets up and he proceeds to sing the Byrds song, Turn, 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 which was a top 10 rock song just 2 years earlier. And someone on the administration, I think, was a little bit embarrassed to see that that actually happened. So the song, as it appears in our text, is beautiful just the way it is. All right, we don't need a tune from the Byrds or the bees or the turtles or exploding mushrooms, for that matter. You didn't know there was a group in 1970, 71 maybe. I was actually part of a garage band called the Exploding Mushrooms. Don't laugh at that. You know. You had to have something that got people's attention, you know. If it wasn't your music, it ought to be whatever. That was another time. All right, let's look at the really good stuff here, the truth that God has for us. All right, God's timing is always right. He has a time for everything. Scope of these verses, I mean, you look at these verses and you just realize these verses are life encompassing. Verse 1, for everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. And so what you're going to read in this poem, which is the first 8 verses, really verses 2 through 8, is a comprehensive view of life. This is what people do. This is not what people should do. That's not what's being taught here. This is just simply a comprehensive, very wide general view of life, of what people do. As we live, we begin to understand that God just has a plan for every single thing under the sun. And so the theme of this chapter, chapter 3, is our ability to learn how to sort out timing. Sort out what's going on in life. Look at the timing of life and be able to make sense of it and realize this is the will of God. God's will is expressed for us in this very thing. Isn't that really what Paul said? Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10. We are His workmanship. We are created in Christ Jesus for what? For good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. So nothing's accidental for the Christian especially. We understand that God has a plan. He has a purpose. And so this text is going to tell us about that purpose, that very, very large scope of life. And yet, even when you try to do that, you're going to run into limitations. I mean, there's only so much that you can possibly do. It's impossible to consider the entire scope of life in 8 verses. So we read these verses and we realize some people are going to do some of these things. All people are going to do some of these things. But not everyone's going to do all of these things. Okay? You know, everybody has to do some of them. There's no question about that. Die, be born, or reverse order probably be more likely. Be born, then die. I mean, we're all going to do that. Weep, laugh, you know, we're all going to be involved in that. And so you can read through this and say, okay, that is a general view of life. But I want you to see the poetic structure of these verses because it's very interesting. In fact, it's very, very instructive for us. This poem is an example of mirism. What is mirism? Well, in rhetoric, in speech, in poems, things like that, it's a figure of speech that teaches a lesson through direct contrast. Now, you can't miss that. When you read through these verses 2 through 8, you just realize there's a lesson being taught to us by making these contrasts. To everything there's a season, the preacher says. Verse 2, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to break down, a time to build up, a time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance. A time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace, a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek, a time to lose, a time to keep, a time to cast away, a time to tear, a time to sow, a time to keep silence, and a time to speak, a time to love, a time to hate, a time for war, and a time for peace. That's a mirism. Teaching lessons through direct contrast. Now, here's something even more interesting. Mirism, this kind of speech, this type of speech, can also be found in law. And when it's found in law, it's like one phrase that implies everything within the scope of the context of that phrase. Time to live, time to be born, time to die, and then it includes everything between time to born, time to... Well, what is that? That's life. And so with these simple contrasts, what we're seeing is a statement that says, this is life. Somewhere in all of this, your life is going to fit between life and death. Feelings of love, feelings of hate, you know, all these different experiences, seeking and losing, whatever. But also, we see one other thing possible here, and this is possible, okay? An illustration of completion. Why do I say that? Well, actually, what you have here are 14 contrasts of 2. Okay, so you divide that in half, you have 7s. What is 7? In the Bible, 7 is generally the number of completion. Often it shows up in a figurative sense to teach that very lesson. And so what we have here are 2 sets of contrasts that say life is complete because God is in control. I mean, this whole text, chapter 3, is just shouting to us, God is in control. Figure it out. And the sooner you figure it out, the more enjoyable life is going to be. Because this is what we know about God's plan, verse 9 through verse 15. We know certain truths about God's plan, and so we can have confidence in what God is doing because God has already made that clear to us. This is not really a big experiment like Solomon was trying to figure out the meaning of life. And he tried and tested all these different avenues of life to try to get some answers. And we would say in our brilliant 21st century great knowledge that we have of having the entire Bible, well, Solomon, God already told us the plan. You don't really need to experiment. God has told us that he has a plan. And we need to be aware of that plan because if we're not, we're going to be very, very disappointed in reality. Verse 9. It is true when we are doing our work in life, and that's what life consists of so much of the time, we ask this question, what gain has the worker from all his toil? And we do experience all of these various details that Solomon told us about in chapter 1 and chapter 2. And if you've been with us through the whole study, and I think most of you have, you just realize all those frustrating conclusions he came to. Yeah, we're aware of that. That's what work is like. And finally, we come to this point in chapter 3, and we say, oh, but wait a minute. That's not a bunch of haphazard stuff just thrown together. Life is not a jumble of unexplainable circumstances. Yeah, there's frustration, but in that, God has a plan because he has determined a right time for everything in life. To everything, there's a season, and there's a time for everything. But what is to be gained? Well, that question should drive us to figure out God's plan for this vast experience called life. Now think about it. I was born in a particular place. Not just some place. I was born in a particular place. I was born at a particular time. I was born to particular parents, not just any parents. My parents raised me in various locations, all within the same general geographical region. They reared me in a particular kind of setting that was fairly strong on religion. They sent me through the typical common acceptable educational experience in that area. I met a girl who was born in a particular place, at a particular time, to particular parents, raised in a particular way, with religion in her life. And she was sent to the same kind of school system I was sent to, and we got married. She birthed three sons. We reared them very much the way we were reared, three particular sons to two particular parents in a particular place. And they've repeated the process. And now it's really easy to look back and wonder, why did we do what we did? Where was God in all of this? And we've covered a lot of ground in the few years that we've been married and alive, quite a few. And contrary to the conclusions of many of our peers, Pat and I are absolutely convinced that God has revealed to us the details of His plan for our lives in all the circumstances that have come along in our life. We just don't have any doubt about it. We are doing what God would have us to do because He has continually, over and over and over and over, through all the circumstances, revealed to us that He has a particular plan for a particular time for particular people. And that's what this chapter is all about. That is called life. And it is God's business. That's what Solomon said. This is God's business. A second part of God's business, you'll notice in verse 10, is work. It's God's ordained business. I have seen the business that God has given to the children of men to be busy with. Now, here's something very interesting. When you see this statement here mentioning God, I've seen what God has done, and He's given this business to men, you suddenly realize that there's been very little reference to God up to this point. I mean, we've been through two chapters, which is several weeks of preaching, with very few references to God. Chapter 1, verse 13, I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of men to be busy with. So there we saw God has given an unhappy business to people. Chapter 2, verse 24, look there. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. Verse 26, chapter 2. For to the one who pleases God, to pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner he's given business of gathering and collecting only to give to the one who pleases God. So those are the only references to God. Chapter 1 and chapter 2. And all three of those references appeal to the same principle that we see here in verse 10. I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man. It's God's business. And here we're just faced clearly with the reality. God determines what we do in life. He gives the business. He ordains, chapter 1, verse 13, chapter 3, verse 10. Work in and of itself without God is going to end in a very unhappy circumstance. No satisfaction. Why? Chapter 2, verse 18, because we work all our life and we're hard, we work hard, we're diligent, we're wise, and we gather whatever we gather and we leave it all behind. And when we leave it all behind, chapter 2, verse 19, how do we know that we're not going to leave it to a fool who's going to squander it? And chances are pretty good we will. And so we work all our lives and we give everything that we have gained to someone who hasn't done one thing to earn it, chapter 2, verse 21. Conclusion, chapter 2, verse 24, then what pleasure is there in all of this work that God has given us to do? Well, you realize it's a gift from God, and so we ought to enjoy it. In fact, verse 26, chapter 2, it's his prerogative to give that blessing to whoever he will. And so the great experiment, with all the passing aspects of life, simply reveal that you cannot dismiss God from your life, from your endeavors, from your pursuits, and all your work, and come to a meaningful, satisfying conclusion about life. And that's what the preacher tells us. We come to chapter 3 and we just realize now, oh, after these experiments, he's come to this conclusion that God is central to everything in life. And if you don't acknowledge that, life's going to be unsatisfying. It's going to be a disappointment. It's going to be a discouragement. God is central to every activity. And that's the difference between you and the typical sinner. To them, they are central. And they are trying to find satisfaction in things that are passing away, changing, and they're always unsatisfying. And you say, ah, the center of life is not me. Life's not about me. It's about God. And so, that is why it's our responsibility to figure out God's plan. And when you try to do this, like Solomon has been trying to do in the first couple of chapters, it's going to drive us to certain conclusions. One of those conclusions is this. God does good. Verse 11. He's made everything beautiful in its time. Now, that word, the Hebrew word for the English translation, beautiful, it's fairly common. Used 41 different times in the Old Testament, only twice in Ecclesiastes. And it talks about something that, which you would think, beautiful, fair, attractive, lovely, appealing. What is fair, beautiful, lovely, attractive, appealing? Well, in Ezekiel chapter 28, verse 7, this is exactly the word it is used to describe the king of Tyre. You say, well, you know, I can see that. You know, here's a king of a very powerful city, and yeah, he's probably beautiful and attractive. Yeah, but it's really a figure of speech. Because in Ezekiel 28, almost certainly what's being spoken of there is Lucifer, Satan. And God said, I created you beautiful, attractive, lovely, and you fell. And the amazing thing is, you see the word used two more times, once in Psalm 45:2, once in Isaiah 33:17, and it's talking about, same word, talking about Messiah. And so now we read here that God has made everything in life beautiful, attractive, appealing. And you know that's true. Originally in the Garden of Eden, everything was exactly the way that it should be. It was honoring to God. It was beautiful. It was lovely. And everything about God's creation was right. But sin has ruined all that. So what do we do with Solomon's conclusion? He has made everything beautiful, notice, in its time. There's another definition, another use of this particular Hebrew word. Yes, it means beautiful and attractive, but it also means, in fact, if you're using a New American Standard tonight, you'll see this translation, fitting or appropriate. God has made everything appropriate for its time. And that is the teaching of this text. Because God is in control. Sure, he makes everything beautiful. He makes everything attractive in its time. But he continues to manage his creation. He is in control of all things right now. God didn't make everything beautiful, step back and say, I hope it works. No, God made everything beautiful, and now he is involved in a very real way in life, in your life. And right now, God is making everything appropriate and fitting in your life according to his timing. That's pretty exciting. And we know this. How do we know it?
Well, because God wrote it on our conscience.
Last part of verse 11, also he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. So on the one hand, what we see according to this statement is we all have this sense of eternity in our souls. What that means is every single normal human being who has not come to the point of searing his or her conscience so that it doesn't work anymore knows that there is something beyond this life. There's something more than what we are seeing and experiencing in this life right now. And that's kind of what Solomon concluded. You know, through all of his experiments in all these various areas of life, he comes to this conclusion, chapter 3, verse 14, I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. He said, I just knew this. I have not been on the other side yet. I have not been in eternity yet, but I know this is true. Why? Well, because God has put this in my soul. I know it. You know it. Every person knows this naturally. In Romans, Paul put it like this. He said, that's because, Romans chapter 2, God has written His law on our conscience. And that's why we just seem to have an innate understanding of what is right, what is wrong, what is acceptable. Why? Because God has put His law on our conscience. And so we're just familiar with certain truths and character about God. Augustine, the old bishop of Hippo, hundreds of years ago, Hippo being a city, not an animal, wrote this. You have made us for yourself. Our hearts are restless until they find peace with you. That's what you're doing. That's what all your peers are doing. That's what everybody in your family is doing. They are restless trying to find God who made us for Himself. And some of you are sitting there saying, you know, I don't have the best memory, but I can remember 2 weeks ago, Pastor, when you weren't so hot on that topic. Right? Right. Romans chapter 3, verse 11 and verse 12. No one understands. No one seeks for God. All turned aside. Together they've all become worthless. No one does good, not even one. Kind of shoots a hole through that theory, doesn't it? Chapter 1, verse 28. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to debased mind to do what they ought not to do. John chapter 21, verse 14. They say to God, depart from us. Job, I'm sorry. Depart from us. We do not desire the knowledge of your ways. What do we do? Did God create us in His image? Did God put the desire for Him in our hearts? Did God place eternity in our hearts? Yes. And then people spend the rest of their lives searching for their own version of God. They know there's that God-like form, shape, void in their life. But they don't want God. And so they spend the rest of their lives chasing gods of their own imagination, trying to satisfy their longing for eternity in their souls by things and thoughts that are passing away, that are temporal, not eternal. Paul put it like this, Romans 1, 23, they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. God has placed a sense about Him in our souls. And that should drive us to try to figure out what His plan is for us. He has something He wants us to do. So what do we perceive? When we search after God and we try to discover what God's plan is for our lives, we're going to discover certain truths that are very, very encouraging. One is that God's plan is for us to be joyful. Figuring out God's plan is just going to make us happy and make us want to do good. Verse 12, I perceive there's nothing better for them than to be joyful and do good for as long as they live. So here's the preacher. He's done the experiments. He's looked at life. Suddenly he goes back to the reality. God's in control. God's in charge. And there's a time for everything and a season for everything. And it's according to God's plan. And so therefore, there's nothing better for us than to acknowledge that, submit to it, be joyful, do good. That word perceive, you know it. It's a very common Hebrew word. It's Hebrew word yada, which means to know. And you know, all the different meanings of that word all through the Old Testament.
And they all refer to, speak of, something that has to do with knowledge or knowing or coming to know. And more often than not, this word is used in a sense of learning through experience, coming to know through experience. So the preacher says, I have come to know. Through this experience, I've come to know there's nothing better than to be joyful and do good. Fits very well with his experience. But who determines what constitutes joy? Having concluded that God determines the timing and the events of life, well, the preacher says, well, let's go in this direction. Let's have joy. But who says what joy is? Well, who's in control? Who's in charge? Who governs? Who manages life? God. Well, let's ask God what constitutes joy. He should have a good definition. In the same way, who determines what constitutes good? If Solomon began his investigation, you remember back in chapter 2, verse 1, seeking satisfaction through everything that is called, and the word that's used there, English word that's used there, is pleasure. That's the same Hebrew word. He said, I was looking for that which everybody else calls good, and I couldn't find it because God is the essence of good, and I wasn't looking at God. I wasn't searching for God, and it's His character that defines good. And that's why we find pleasure and do good only in Him, which is going to impact all of our mundane life, so much of which is boring or unpleasant. I got to go to work again. Man, not another day at the salt mine. Well, wait. Enjoy what God has given you. Even that opportunity, verse 13, also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. Why? Well, this is God's gift to man. What is God's gift to man? The toil or the drink and pleasure? The answer to that is yes. God's gift to us is the opportunity to toil, and God's gift to us is the fruit, the rewards we get because of the toil. Take God out of the equation and you're toiling without God, you ought to be miserable. Your job ought to be just a real pain in the neck, you know, whatever you're doing, discouraging, futile, whatever. Put God back in that equation, and now we're not working for ourselves. Now we're not working for our own pleasure. We're working for God. It is His, to His glory. It is His ministry, and the reward of that is joy and pleasure. So that God would say, here's my reward to you. You work hard. I give you the strength. I give you the opportunity. I give you the time. I give you the energy to do this work. And you get rewards from that work. I have given you those rewards. Always acknowledge that and you'll be able to enjoy the rewards. They're God's. Chapter 2, verse 24 said they were gifts from God's hand. And when we finally get it into our head that this is God's life and He is in control of these circumstances, then we can understand how He maintains control of everything. You know what that's going to do to us? I don't know if you ever sit around and think about this. You probably don't have time to sit around and think, do you? But when you have the opportunity to just think, God is managing all of these circumstances in my life. They're not just things happening. They're things that He is bringing into my life on purpose so that in Him I can find joy and reward and satisfaction. Yeah, the right conclusion to that should be F-E-A-R. And I spell that because I thought you might misunderstand me. Because it doesn't make any sense, does it? You know, when I finally become satisfied in God and I'm really convinced He's in control and I really believe He has my circumstances all ordered for my good, why would I fear Him? Well, because that's what respect looks like. Verse 14, I perceived, I'm testing, I'm looking, I'm watching, observing, drawing conclusions, that whatever God does endures forever, nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it, God has done it, so that people fear before Him. This is a reference to God's sovereign control over all things. Whatever's happening in your life, get this, okay? Whatever's happening in your life right now, God has done it. It's already done. He already determined this in eternity. Yeah, really, folks, you just have to understand, God is not up in heaven wringing his hands, saying, now look what he's done. How am I going to fix this problem? No, he's already determined this. He has done it. He has determined the outworking and the time for all things, and no one can change it, and no one can add to it, and no one can take from it. How does that make you feel? Kind of makes me feel like a fool sometimes. Because you know what I do? I can say that, and I can say I believe that. And then there are times where I try to take control of circumstances. And I try to manipulate things, and I try to manipulate people. And basically what I'm saying is, hey, God, this is a great plan. Now let's just fine-tune this thing a little bit. You say, you are so stupid. You know, is God in control? Has he already done this? Has he already determined? Then why am I trying to do this? Because we delude ourselves. It's like Jeremiah said, the heart is deceitful above everything. It's desperately sick. So we delude ourselves and we're not in control at all. You want proof of this? Look at your life. How many times do you end up causing the same problem over and over and over? How many times do you run into the same wall over and over? How many times do you trip over the same stone over and over and over? How many times do you cause yourself the same pain over and over and over? Someone said the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. I always quote that to myself when I'm playing golf. Yeah, it's insanity, you know. Same thing over and over. You know why the ball slices? Because you're doing the same thing over and over and over. That's the way life is. We make the same mistakes over and over and over, have the same pain over and over, we cause the same problems over and over, because we forget that it's God who's in control. And he uses the walls and the bumps and the bruises and the stones and the pain and the sorrow to try to teach us this very, very important lesson. He is in control. My problem is I'm stubborn, I'm self-centered, and I'm determined. And the more stubborn, self-centered, and determined I am, the more painful it is. And that's why Solomon says, you know, it's a whole lot better to realize God has already taken care of these things. God is in control. He's managing all these circumstances. Fear him. Have utmost respect for him. Because God's intent for all these things in our life is for us to admit that he is more powerful than we are. Even more powerful than we can possibly imagine. His intent is that we would become so astonished by his control that we'd really be afraid to resist his power. His intent is that we should learn what utmost respect for our Creator looks like and practice it. And I know that respect does not treat lightly. It doesn't argue. And it doesn't assume that God's wrong and I'm right. It assumes God's right. And therefore, respect requires that I submit to God. And it's a good thing for us to do that because God repeats his work. That's why we keep learning the same lessons. Verse 15. That which is already has been. That which is to be already has been. God seeks what has been driven away. So God proves that he is in control by his very, very consistent maintenance of all things. And he is in control, by the way, all the way to the end. Look at the last part of this verse. It has a really interesting statement. God seeks what has been driven away. You see, God's control extends to all of our thoughts, our plans, our purposes, our activities, And in eternity, when we stand before him, he goes back and grabs all that stuff out of the past and seeks that which has been driven away, brings it up and says, this is a lesson I was trying to teach you. So what are our conclusions, generally speaking? Quickly, let's run through just these last couple of verses here. We've learned this so many times. Human governance fails. Verse 16, moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness, even there is wickedness. We expect justice. We expect righteousness. God ordains leaders for that task. God expects those he ordains, his leaders and his judges, his rulers, to give us justice and righteousness. We don't get it. In fact, notice we experience wickedness where we ought to experience justice. So what do? We get very frustrated. We switch from this party to that party. And we decide finally, cynically, there's no hope. Why even bother the vote? I'm just going to stay home. That has really nothing to do with it. We just go back to the fact God has everything under control, because he's the final judge. Verse 17. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. God has a time for testing. I said in my heart with regard to the children of man that God is testing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. What a horrible conclusion. But folks, so often that's exactly where we end up. No smarter than Fluffy or Fido. And God is putting us to the test and letting us see this is what you are. And it's God who determines the eternal destinies. You know, sometimes you hear people talk about this kind of stuff. It's a little bit discouraging to me, but, you know, I mean, I know what it's like to get close to an animal. I was very, very close to my horses. And, you know, my wife wouldn't even let me bring them in the house.
At least you get to have your cat and your dog in the house.
But we're supposed to be more important than that. Verse 19, for what happens to the children of man, what happens to the beasts, it's all the same. One dies, so dies the other. Blah, you know, they all have the same breath. Man has no advantage over the beasts for all his vanity. Whoa, 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 hold on, Solomon. Verse 20, man, he is really discouraged now. All go to the same place. We're all from dust, dust we all return. And yeah, but wait. There's a difference. Verse 21. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? Man has an eternal spirit. Beast doesn't. And the key word is eternal. Is God in control of animals? Yeah. And birds don't fall out of the nest, but what he knows about it. And he cares. Last night, my wife and I, was that last night? Maybe the night before. We were outside. Cicadas start up. Don't you just love those things? And I turned to my wife and I said, I love being a southerner so much. That's a southern thing, you know? Sweat, humidity, and cicadas.
And God worries about, doesn't worry, he cares about those little green bugs that make life so pleasant for us.
But I'm way more important than that, and so are you. They die. I die. I have an eternal spirit. And so God says, then would you rest in me? Would you just let me take care of things? Verse 22, so I saw that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? This is the wonderful conclusion we come to after we have finally figured out there's a time for everything. And God is in control of that timing. And God is in control of all of these events that make up life. And yeah, we work, we toil, we labor. We try to achieve something to leave something behind. But all that we achieve in this life is only valuable insofar that we know that God is in control. And so, If we just come to this conclusion and say, all right, this is true. God is in control of all things in my life. I have to go to work. I'm going to go to work. I'm going to enjoy my work because it's God. And God has ordained this, and God is concerned for me. And so I'm going to enjoy the blessings that He gives because I can rest in His control. And that gives us great, great confidence when we start seeing God's hand moving. You know, really, when something happens in your life that's a bit unusual, sometimes it's an incredible blessing. And more often than not, it's something you really would rather didn't come into your life. When that happens, what's the first question you ask? What is wrong with that person? No. Okay, what's God trying to teach me? What does God want me to know about Himself? That's always the first question we ask. What does God want me to know about Himself? You know, I think more often than not, as soon as something comes into our life, our first question is, okay, God, what sin did I do now? Why are You punishing me now? Well, He's not punishing you. He's bringing these circumstances into you. Oh, wait, there might be some sin in your life you need to take care of. But He's bringing these circumstances in your life to make you realize He is in charge. And He wants you to respect that. He wants you to understand what He is doing, why He's doing it. And then He says, now that's how you have joy. Just this daily assurance, life's not about me. Life's not about my plans. Life is not about my purposes. Life is not about my desires. Life is about God's plan, purposes, and desires for me. And when I'm able to acknowledge that, I can rest in that. And I can enjoy that. And it makes life so much more enjoyable as I know that God is doing His will through me.